Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Hume, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Emma Powell, news editor. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to talk about the banks because with the exception of Standard Chartered, they have all now reported. So we can start having a sort of a comparative look at them and how healthy they are. And Julia, for sure. How are you doing, Julia?
I'm good, John.
Excellent. And you've written the sexy focus this week, which is on sustainability in consumer goods companies.
That's right.
Well, sounds very right on. but is it good for profits? And I guess that's the big question that you're exploring here. We've got some evidence in the form of results from Reckitt that can put some sort of financial meat on that question.
That's right.
Shall we start with the banks? So RBS, everyone liked these results because the four-year dividend has been paid.
Yeah, exactly. They're really well capitalised. They kind of have to be.
They're overcapitalised,
and they've got permission now to start redistributing that to shareholders, which is good. And they're going to start buying back the government stake, which is also good.
Yeah, so I'd imagine there's lots of people who hold these because they happened to be holding them when everything went belly up all those years ago. No point selling them. We're starting to see a bit of a recovery here. Is this sustainable? Yeah, I guess is the big question.
Well, from a capital perspective, obviously they're doing a lot better, but the big unknown is Brexit, isn't it?
Yes. But what's that going to affect, really? I mean, housing. I mean, the housing side of things looks strong.
Yeah, I mean, it's just on the impairment side, really. I mean, actually, RBS have been one of the more cautious banks because, I don't know if you remember, but they made that £200 million Brexit provision during the last quarter, which was kind of different from a lot of the other banks. It literally just depends on whether impairments do start to rise. They're quite benign at the moment, but then interest rates are very low. So
yeah, but there's no sign of them going north anytime soon. So
well, no, exactly. And the key thing with the banks, I mean, a lot of the reason I guess investors hold them is for the dividend. And dividends are looking stronger than ever for all the banks, really, and so are capital levels. So
and buybacks as well as dividends as well, obviously, which we saw at Lloyds.
Lloyds, yeah, 1.75 billion, which I think the market was kind of expecting 1.2, 1.3, so that was a lot better than expected.
So that, I would assume they're overcapitalised as well, that they're giving all this money back in whatever form it's coming back.
Yeah, they're ahead of their management's target for their kind of regulatory capital as well. So, and their capital generation has always been the strongest of all the banks.
Yeah, and I mean, Lloyds, as we've always talked about, much more UK-focused than a lot of their peers.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, what are the strengths of these results reflect? Where is the good news coming from?
Well, the good news mainly is kind of capital generation. They beat actually the big thing that kind of differentiates them between kind of Barclays and RBS, which are also kind of more UK focused, is that their net interest margin actually rose as well. And that's really surprising because the mortgage market being as competitive as it is, you know, RBS and kind of Barclays have seen a bit of kind of erosion there, whereas Lloyds haven't. They've managed to kind of hold that margin and actually grow it, which is really surprising and encouraging.
Okay, so but the housing market is important to them.
Yes, very important to them.
But there's no sign of any weakness there. I mean, we've talked about it on recent podcasts. House builders looking good at the moment. Lots of people still want to buy. Lots of first-time buyers out there. Lots of support in the form of Help to Buy. So good times roll.
Well, yeah.
They also, you mentioned your rise up here. There was a slight increase in impairments. But
yeah,
the numbers
just slightly.
Are kind of tiny.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I mean. They're historically very benign, which is what, I mean, you would kind of expect that at the moment, though, because interest rates are low.
Yeah, I mean, going back to RBS, there's a phrase that jumped out at me in that result right up, which was geopolitical uncertainty. Presumably that's not just Brexit that you're referring
to.
No,
that's also kind of, they also talk about trade wars and things like that. I mean, actually, that's probably, I guess, a lot more pertinent to HSBC. And I think generally what we've seen so far, even though we've got Standard Chartered yet to report on Tuesday, I think it's fair to say there's a split between the kind of UK focused and the Asia focused banks.
Yeah, so HSBC results were generally perceived as quite disappointing.
Yeah, they were disappointing. I think the shares fell around 4% on the day, which is kind of contrasting with those other three banks that have reported. And it's generally because they've got quite a balancing act actually at the moment between they're trying to expand across China and the rest of Asia, but they're also trying to keep costs down. And that's you know, a really fine balancing act for them. Obviously, they want to take advantage of what they see as the market opportunity there. But, you know, investors are obviously very wary of costs keep rising. And that's, you know, without kind of mentioning the fact that their markets business didn't do very well for the obvious reason during the fourth quarter, you know, a bit of a weakness in confidence in Asia.
So you talk about something called the jaws.
Oh, the jaws. Yeah, that's a bit of a HSBC term.
And this is the differential between
revenue growth and cost growth. And you want to see like a positive. So basically revenue growing faster than costs. They incurred, I think it's 1.2% negative, so cost rising more than revenue, which obviously isn't good.
Did they talk about the sort of general concerns around China in their update? I mean, we wrote about it in quite some depth last week.
No, so I know obviously we wrote about China a lot in terms of the debt. They actually didn't really mention that, funnily enough, even though they'd be massively exposed to that.
I would thought that's kind of key thing for them to talk about.
Of course it is, but my guess would be is because it's the big unknown, like will all these loans turn toxic? We don't know yet. So they just kind of talk about 2019 also likely to be very challenging for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, presumably, I mean, the debt we were talking about in China, it's not all bank debt with banks like HSBC.
Exactly.
A lot of it is in the shadow banking system or whatever it may be. HSBC presumably has, I must talk about the sort of quality of its lending in China.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there wasn't a big rise in impairments or anything. So that's key. I guess it's like whether that will unravel further down the road.
Mm. They also have a big UK operation, of course, which looks pretty decent, in fact.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a much smaller part of their business. I mean, they do actually, they did warn a little bit in terms of credit quality, but I think that's more for kind of this year rather than them actually seeing, you know, a big rise in kind of impairments or anything yet.
Mm. And you mentioned in your write-up that mortgage lending's growing over here still. So, again, supportive of the idea that the housing market remains relatively strong. Let's talk about Barclays, which isn't in the magazine, but you've written that up today.
Yeah.
This is interesting too, because there is a kind of big, I mean, we talk about HSBC in the context of its, you know, it's essentially two banks in one, China and the UK. Barclays is kind of the same. And there's a little bit more pressure to do something about this, which you've talked about in your piece.
Yeah, exactly. So the kind of big story around Barclays at the moment has been Edward Bramson, who's an activist investor. He's been kind of agitating for Barclays to drop their investment bank. He thinks they should just focus on kind of lower risk retail banking. He's also been pushing to get a seat on the board. He hasn't succeeded yet. But these results actually, again, kind of well received by the market. And you can see why, because actually the investment bank outperformed its peers. So the kind of investment banking peers in the US and in Europe. You know, there was a bit of decline in terms of fixed income trading and things like that, but it wasn't as bad as their peers have seen. And actually, crucially, which is kind of the biggest thing people look for, its returns on tangible equity increased quite a lot. I mean, it's still inferior to the retail banking side of things, which, you know, will attract criticism, but returns have improved there a lot. So I don't know whether this is a bit of a riposte to Edward Bramson, you know.
My understanding of investment banking is that it's much more lumpy, I guess.
Yeah.
So, you know,
high risk.
So there are the opportunities for big ups and downs, you know, big gains, but also big losses.
Yeah.
Which I guess is Edward Bramson's argument. But that's being very, very strongly resisted by the management at Barclays at the moment. I mean, why is this? I mean, this battle seems to be going on for as long as I can remember.
A long time, yeah. And obviously, Jez Staley who's the chief executive, has a history in investment banking. So that's obviously got to play a part. And they've just been very committed, like you say, to the fact that, yeah, there are these highs and lows, but the potential upside, you know, could be great. Then I guess the kind of takeaway, that the kind of negative, though, on that side is that you have to, because it's so high risk, park a lot of tangible equity against your investment banking operations. That means you can't, you know, you can't grow the other side of the business as much. So if you've got poor returns, but you're, you know, obviously parking a lot of equity against that side of the business, you can see, you know, why people might get annoyed if your returns are quite low.
I guess the idea being that they could just do better by putting all their capital behind part of the business.
Put it to better use on the retail side of things.
I mean, we talked about RBS and Lloyds looking very strong in that sort of capital adequacy ratio measure. How does Barclays look by comparison?
Its capital ratio, I think, was around 13.2%.
A little bit lower then.
It's a bit lower, but it's still just slightly ahead of management's target. And obviously they've reinstated their dividend now to 6.5p, which is what analysts were hoping for. The key thing with them was they had this settlement with the Department of Justice in the US over residential mortgage-backed securities, the mis-selling of them historically. But they've settled that, which is why basically they could reinstate the dividend.
Yeah. Lloyds also, I mean, going back to kind of provisions for mis-selling, Lloyds, those numbers seem to be shrinking with every passing.
Yeah, PPI is a big one for them.
But getting smaller, the banks, they look a lot cleaner. And I guess the key takeaway from all of the banking results so far is that they look much stronger than they have done for a while, and a lot cleaner and a lot more attractive. Do we think they're worth buying now?
I mean, for obvious reasons, the valuations are depressed. So HSBC and Standard Chartered, that's because of the kind of trade wars in the UK. You know, unsurprisingly right now, financial services companies generally, but banks in particular, their shares are depressed. I would say really, especially with Lloyds, if you look at how well capitalised they are, the strength of the capital generation, I definitely think they're worth buying.
Decent dividends, I mean, in terms of the yield as well.
So, exactly. I mean, as long as they can keep paying out those dividends and they stay well capitalised, I think at their current valuations, they are worth buying.
So you've got Lloyds on a buy, Barclays on a buy.
Yeah.
HSBC on a buy.
Buy. It's maintained the dividends.
Seems a bit riskier, but...
It's risky, but it's like, I think it yields around 6%. They last cut the dividend in 2009.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's been maintained steady. But yeah, of course, it's like a higher risk income stock.
And RBS is the only
RBS
one you've got
on a
hold.
Yeah.
Not convinced yet then?
No, not quite yet.
All right. So yeah, lots of, I guess bank reports are massive. So if you want to go away and read them yourself, you've got a spare week or two, then
exactly.
Good luck with that. But there's a lot to get for investors to get their teeth into here, both in terms of the information that's out there and potentially as decent looking investments right now. So excellent. Julia, let's talk about sustainability, mm-hmm. Which is the subject of your sector focus this week. Now, you're looking at it in the context of consumer goods companies. And I guess that's a useful place to start because they produce the majority of what we consume. Mm-hmm. Talk us through the kind of thesis behind this piece.
Yeah, I mean, sustainability is something that is being seen across sectors, but for the sake of the sector focus, decided to look specifically at consumer goods companies, especially as Unilever's new chief executive, Alan Jope, was at Davos a couple of weeks ago, talking about how there's going to be a seismic change within the industry and that...
Did he get there by private plane? Was he one of the hundreds of private planes that rocked up at Davos to talk about the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't asked him, but I think that's probably a pretty safe bet. But yeah, it's all talking about how brands are supposed to make kind of the world a better place. And I think this sort of movement hinges on kind of two elements. And the first being a lot of consumers want to buy products that are good for them. They want things to be more natural, more organic. They kind of know where the ingredients are coming from. And then the other side of it is those products, the production of them, aren't bad for the environment.
Okay, so this will sound...
minimal impact.
This all sounds really great, but not everyone is convinced.
No.
You found a naysayer who thinks this is a little more than a sort of marketing exercise.
Yeah, one analyst that I spoke to was very adamant that he thinks it's all hogwash, as he said.
Hogwash.
One of the more milder terms that he used in the conversation, but saying, basically it's all a glorified marketing scheme. They just kind of look at the market as it is today and realize that millennials, who tend to be the ones who stereotypically care a lot more about these two sorts of elements, are the ones who are really coming into the spending power. And so if that's the case, clearly these companies need to cater to their demands.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not a millennial, but are you? I guess you are.
I'm definitely a millennial.
Yeah, I can never work out the dates of these things. So you're both millennials. I mean, is this, when you go shopping, do you care about the environment? Do you think, I'm not going to buy that because it's got too much plastic around it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've definitely been guilty of, if I'm looking at two products and one says, you know, natural and organic, the other one says nothing, and there's not a huge price difference between the two, like, of course I'm going to go for that one. Especially cleaning products and stuff as well, if they're, like, full of chemicals and you can get one that's a similar price that isn't, that's still effective.
I must admit.
I think I'm probably, judging by the looks on your faces right now, the one that this
is more
appealed to.
No, I would agree. I just question, there's things like, I guess, like, I'm thinking of Unilever and, I don't know, shampoo and stuff and all the plastic that's kind of sold in. How do you get rid of that? And, like, how much difference is there between these products supposedly sustainable?
Yeah, that was one thing the analyst was talking about as well, especially, like, you know, you can say that this, you know, cleaning product is, you know, zero carbon footprint, and when it goes back down the drain, it's not going to be bad for the environment. But at the same time, what packaging did it come in?
Well, this is interesting.
Is it plastic? Is it recycled?
Well, this is quite interesting because there is this big backlash against plastic, and plastic is in so much of what we buy, whether it's food or you know, cleaning products or, you know, personal care products. BP actually came out this week and said something quite controversial. So they publish every year their Energy Outlook, I think it's called. It's a huge document. And they came out and said, this is all very well and good, but actually, if you stop using plastic, what's the alternative? And there's every chance that that will actually do more harm to the environment than the plastic itself, in terms of the energy used to produce it and transport it.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic is lightweight and easy to transport. Glass bottles, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite difficult.
Yeah, and another difficult element to it as well is that, I mean, you can say that things are all natural or made with natural ingredients or something like that, but at the same time, some of the regulations around that are a bit looser. It's kind of, you can stick it on the outside of the package and, I don't know,
just charge
be a bit of a woolly term sometimes.
Charge a bit more for it?
Yeah, true.
I mean, this is quite interesting as well, because, you know, the whole millennial debate is that millennials don't have enough money to spend on this kind of stuff. You know, everything's very tight. Saving away, you know, scribbling stuff away, what's left over a deposit. But at the same time, this group also wants to spend large amounts of money on, you know, more environmentally friendly organic products. There seems to be a little bit of a mismatch in that argument.
That's true. And perhaps maybe from the consumer goods, like the producer's point of view, it's that may be the case now, but they think perhaps later down the line that spending power will increase. And so if you're going to start targeting these future customers, you should probably just start doing it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there is something to be said for this, I have to say. I'm not a skeptic. I do think, you know, companies should behave better. And I think it's something you wrote about a while back, Emma, in a tip you wrote on a company called Impax Asset Management.
Yeah.
Which is an investment management firm that runs a number of funds.
Yeah, it's
that
ESG investing, yeah.
ESG being environmental,
social and governance.
Yeah. And it's done really well. So the tip's done really well. The funds are doing really well. And I guess there is a school of thought that if companies behave well, you know, if they don't produce massive externalities that are bad for the environment or society, and they are well run in terms of their governance, then they will do better. And Impax seems to kind of bear that out.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing with Impax as well is that if you look at kind of compare them to other asset managers at the moment, and you see the kind of, you know, that a lot of asset managers are incurring, you know, massive outflows, they've continued to gain net new money, basically. So it's definitely the demand there for ESG investing is definitely growing, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, this is institutional money that we're talking
about.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Well, I think you can also invest, obviously, as a retail investor too. But
absolutely, I think one of their funds on our top 100 list.
Yeah,
so you can buy it.
So you can. But I think, again, like if you had the choice between an ESG investor investment company, you know, one that wasn't, why wouldn't you invest your money with that?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, there was once a school of thought, and I'm not sure kind of where it came from, but that you had to sacrifice returns to invest in an ethical manner. But the numbers don't really support that, particularly when you look at impacts. One company you mentioned in this piece, Julia, is Reckitt Benckiser. Now, you know, they make some of the most brutal cleaning products out there. You know, Silit Bang. I've never really thought of that as environmentally friendly. But
perhaps not.
But they're kind of shifting the way they do things to generally be a better company.
Yeah, they're kind of two shifts, really. As the company as a whole is going through this transformation from kind of your standard consumer goods company to specifically health and hygiene company, as they said. So towards the end of 2017, they sold off their any of their food division, and they bought this company called Mead Johnson Nutrition, which does infant formulas and nutrition products and such. And so that's kind of the first element of that shift. And then, again, as you say, a lot of those cleaning products, not particularly environmentally friendly. And I think they're quite aware of that and are trying. When you speak to them or you go on their website, they have some quite clear objectives, such as reducing the carbon footprint of when they're manufacturing these products. And having it already actually has met its target of having zero waste to landfills.
That's
three years ahead of the target. So yeah,
which is quite important.
It's an ongoing process, but that's definitely a big achievement so far.
Is it translating into a good financial performance? I guess would be for our readers, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, I mean, they had full year results last week, and judging by those, it seems to be right on track. I mean, at the interims, prior to that, this infant nutrition business had done so well, they increased their forecast for revenue, and then for the full year, and now the full year results have come out, they hit the top end of that. So at this point, it seems like it's a transition that's paying off.
Absolutely. I noticed in your piece that the chief exec is leaving.
Yeah, unfortunate timing considering the transition and the integration of Mead Johnson into the rest of the business, but yeah. They're searching for a successor, and
do we have any idea who that might be? Or is this all?
No, they've been tight-lipped about it so far. But
yeah.
But yeah, no. That doesn't seem to have spooked the shares necessarily at this point.
Well, I mean,
performance has been good.
Yeah, they have weakened over the last half of 2018, but what didn't? What didn't? Bouncing back now. Let's just go back to the feature. One of the things that's often talked about is palm oil.
And you love to email me after I write about anything to do with palm oil and what about the orangutans and the effect on the environment. So
Robbo used to get sent various literature about orangutans. He used to come palm oil, and it is one of those industries or sub industries that has a pretty horrible reputation.
Yeah, and they, I mean,
and but it's in everything.
Yeah, it's true. Palm oil is still it's in everything, and they, again, have good intentions. It's kind of hard to pick apart where, saying that you've joined this roundtable on sustainable palm oil, that's immediately going to transition into a better impact on the environment.
Mm.
But I guess it's a step in the right direction. But one thing that I've always kind of find baffling about something like an MP Evans is that, they'll have the results, you'll speak to them on the phone, you get the email and stuff, and then, the next week, this massive package, paper package, will arrive in the mail with the same thing you talked about to them last week. Which, I mean, if they're talking about there's no deforestation and they're all good for the environment and stuff, it just seems to be a departure. Even just little things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, palm oil is, as I say, it's in a lot of things. People like Unilever have, companies like Unilever have reduced their use of this, or they're trying to reformulate products to use less of this material,
or alternative oils and such.
Yeah, I mean, do we see any signs that that's having an impact on some of the palm oil players out there?
Whenever I cover palm oil results, it's not necessarily that's their biggest concern, though it is evident. It's such a cyclical business that their results really depend on production that year, even
weather.
Just things like the weather. Yeah,
I covered these for a bit, and weather was always
and even
the big unknown.
Yeah, and even the price of alternative oils and stuff too. Soybean oil is significantly cheaper than if these companies that are making these products have palm oil can kind of substitute some of that in, they will do it.
Mm.
And so, yeah, as of the last set of results from the palm oil companies, it kind of seemed to be like that cycle was going towards the downturn. So we're staying away from those at the moment.
I think that's quite sensible. You can play the ESG theme through things like companies themselves or through some of the funds out there, which have been good performers. Impact is an interesting company to look at. Do we still like those shares? Yes.
We've got a bias still. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a secular trend, and I think one that we should all pay attention to. I don't think it's bad to be thinking about the environment as an investor these days, or other things that are good for society. Thank you very much, Julia. Thank you, Emma. There's lots and lots in the magazine this week. We haven't talked about the cover feature, which is our annual look at the commercial property market, the property forecast. It's written by Jonas Crossed and Mark Robinson. There's lots and lots of information there on what the post-Brexit prospects are for commercial property. Lots of worries over that sector, given the worries about a potential exodus from the UK. Should we leave on no-deal terms? Actually, those worries sort of had a bit of a standard bearer this week in the form of Honda, which you mentioned on the 7 Days page, which is closing a factory. This kind of ties into the environmental theme as well. And it's lots of speculation this is a Brexit-related decision, but they themselves have said it's to do with electric vehicles and the shift from diesel, which I think is mentioned in the sector focus as well, that was a very big problem for the automotive industry, the environmental concerns there. So have a look at that feature. We've got James Norrington's 10-asset portfolio as the second feature. He hasn't updated that for a while. But, it's an interesting look at asset allocation and how to put that into practice. We've got Algie Hall's NEF stock screen looking at cheap cyclical shares. Company results starting to ratchet up as the flurry of banking reports attest to. But there's lots more apart from that. Lots of miners reporting at the moment. And next week looks pretty horrific. It's going to be fun. Lots of the news section. Sainsbury's, bit of a nightmare there for them with the CMA's likely blocking of their takeover or merger with Asda. Alex Newman has looked at the Vale Dam collapse and some of the implications for the mining sector there. And Plus 500. Well, what's going on there, Emma?
That's just a disaster.
It is a
company.
Did we see this coming?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, no, because they wrote in their 2017 accounts that they didn't make any losses from clients benefiting from trading, and then came out with a statement saying, oh, actually, we shouldn't have included the word losses. We didn't mean that.
So it's a misreporting.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Oh, dear. I'm seeing far too much of this lately. Anyway, we've got them on a sale now, and I think that's probably sensible. Anyway, lots more in the magazine this week. Thank you, Julia, and thank you, Emma, and thank you for listening. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents, The Property Forecast, The Outlook for Real Estate in 2019, and we'll be back next week. Thank you.